Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 162nd edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. My guest today is Abdi Iftin, a 30-year-old man who's been in the United States for 3 years. He came by way of Kenya, but was originally from Somalia. He is the second of three children in his family in as many countries today, Somalia, Kenya, and the United States. Welcome to New Mainers Speak, Abdi.
Thank you so much, Kate. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to have such a famous guy here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You'll hear why he's famous in a little bit. Tell us a little bit first about Somalia. Give us a context for your childhood. Tell us what kids were doing for fun when you still lived in Somalia. What kind of games did you play? Where did you gather? That kind of thing.
Thanks for inviting me again to this show. I really think it's a wonderful thing. Somalia is one of the independent countries in the world, and we got our independence in 1960. And way ahead of so many other countries in Africa. And then we had, through the years since the independence, we had so many different administrations that came to the country. And the last one was a dictatorship president under where my parents were there at the time during the 70s and 80s. And unfortunately, when I was born, there was no government that existed at all. So literally when I opened my eyes, it was all chaos and destruction and bloodshed and animosity and, hatred that people were killing each other based on tribes and things like that. So my childhood was, it was two things, actually. Well, one point, I remember so many years that we never had a permanent place to stay. So my mother, who's a nomadic woman, and this is a Somali's typical thing, like most of our parents are nomad, They had animals like goats and
herders.
Yeah, herders, actually, basically. I'm Buster Listis as well. So she remembers wandering around between the two rivers, herding her camels for days and never trying to figure out the house.
So as a child? That was her childhood.
Well, yeah, also as a woman before she moved to the city. Mm-hmm. So her parents and herself would never see each other for years, and they would run into each other again somewhere in the middle of the wilderness. And that was kind of funny thing, but I thought it was really wonderful back then when people did not kill each other. They were nomadic people, and you could freely roam, the country from one end to the other end. But when the Somalis were introduced to gangs, especially by the militias in 1991, and everyone was, especially the grown-up people at the time, they started fighting over resources and land. So the city where I was born, Mogadishu, was one of the cities that the militias were fighting over control. And unfortunately, no militias is more powerful than the other one. So they all had equally the same amount of ammunition and guns. So literally, it meant like they would shoot at each other for days and days and days, and they would never move one inch into the other, other militias territory. So they had no idea how to figure. And the people who are fighting, they have no knowledge of how to use guns. So literally, it was just they got to start using them and figure out how to shoot. And
they didn't know how to use the guns they had.
They did not know how to use the guns that they had. Most of them were younger. They were 12, 13, 15, and to them it was just fun practicing shooting at people who were wandering, in the streets. So my family, we became a target many times. I remember one day we were sitting somewhere on the side of the street, and this sniper was shooting at us, but he could not get us, which I thing, we are so lucky. If he was a professional, if he knew how to use
GANs. Good thing it was just an 11-year-old.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if he knew how to use GANs, we would have been all, you know, shot in the head. But he had no, we would see the bullet flying over us, you know, zipping past us, hitting the wall, hitting the trees. And then we decided to make a run for it, you know. And then again and again, it was just, you know, I grew up in that environment where you get introduced into the world of survival.
So you were a child in survival mode.
I was a child in survival mode.
Were you playing at all? Did you ever get to play and kick the can in the street?
Well, the good thing about the play in Somalia is when the sun sets, it's just dark. And the houses are abandoned. No one lives in those houses. The roofs are gone. The doors are gone. The windows are gone. The walls are cracked. So you can imagine how fun that is, right? So
great hide and seek landscape.
Great hide and seek landscape. That's exactly what my friends and I did. So I would climb up this wall, jump from house to house, and no one lives in there. It's just empty. And I would just keep going for like half a mile into this neighborhood where none of the houses was occupied. And it was a great hide and seek.
Like a playground.
It was a great playground.
Jungle gym.
Yes. The only problem was we could not make a sound. So we couldn't laugh. We couldn't just do this stuff because it kind of attracted attention.
Like a cat.
Yes, kind of. So we kind of stayed low profile. And my friends and I were like, we just whisper each other, catch me, you know. And then we would go. And when it was my turn, I need to figure out how to find a guy where he's hiding. So to me, it was like this wonderful game. And sometimes we don't have food in our bellies. Like we're just doing this without, you know, our parents not able to provide for us. But I think that was part of the great entertainment that I really, really enjoyed. But one other thing, which as a child we played, was soccer. I mean, when I say soccer, it's football back there, back home. And we could not afford to buy the ball itself. So we invented something like, you know, we could find a piece of cloth and put so many different things in that piece of cloth, like a sock, socks. And then we would fill in like, you know, pieces of clothes, you know, cardboard or plastic bag and all that stuff. And then it kind of swells up into like a ball kind of shape. And then we would do something and
tie
then
it off
and tie it off and then throw it on the ground. And then we called it the bugle. It was just wonderful. And we played around with it for all day, you know, when we can, as much as we can.
Probably felt great to let go of your worries, too.
Yes, yes. But literally, I'm not saying we were happy. So the most important thing was that we have to stay safe. And I remember when I was 7 years old and above, I became responsible for taking care of my family. I have an older brother, yes, and he's only a year old. So when he was 8, I was 7. And there was mom, there was my sister. And because mom had been taking care of us since the war started, so when I was 7, I thought, you know, I could do something. So I said, you know, mom, you need to stay, you know, this place. So we found a place. And my brother and I looked at each other in the eyes and I said, why don't we go get some water? And there was only one place that you could go to get water. And that one place was about 3 miles from where we lived. So it's like I have to go up on this hill and then go through this some snipers, like, you know, sitting on the windows or whatever. Sometimes we could run into a bunch of group of militias down the road. You know, it was just extremely dangerous.
It reminds me a lot, Abdiya, of when you watch Lion Cubs playing.
Yeah.
They play rough, but that's how they learn how to hunt. And your playing was to basically play a elevated game of hide and go seek. Mm-hmm. And then that was how you could live, to dodge the snipers to go get water for your family.
I mean, I'm glad that you mentioned the Lion Cubs. Yeah, it's pretty much, if you look at it, the Lion Cubs first depend on their parents. But once they start, you know, become like grown-up males, they have to go, you know, practice killing a prey,
mm-hmm.
zebra, wildebeest, whatever. And then when it's there in that situation, they get into the world of survival on their own. So that's, I think, what our mom was trying to just watch and see. Because as a responsible parent in Somalia, you have to get your kids out on that stage where they're able to provide for their own family, become responsible on their own. And once they can do that, they're just like the lioness, the relationship does not end there. Even if you marry, you got to bring your wife to the house where your mom is, because you would always be the child of your mom. But you have to also be a responsible man, someone who's, you know, creative and can find something.
Would you live in that matrilineal organization?
That's
then?
Right, the matrilineal organization. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. that's our cultural definition of you know, the term that you just used.
I like that one.
Yes. So,
being a mom.
Yeah, but I think because our mom was kind of really sick. And her feet were swelling for years and years of walking on in the middle of, you know, in the wilderness, and also taking us from a place to place, just trying to get us away from the gunshots, taking us to a safer spot, and she's been doing all of this. But when I was 7 and my brother was 8, I thought we realized here we are. You know, this is the time when we jump in and give mom a break. In this case, we need to find something. But, you know, water is the most important thing. So that's why we actually decided to try water first. And people were lining for that one spot where people got the water. But we came up with a pretty good idea, which is like at night, because there is, you know, the militias don't have night vision or anything.
Right, nice, so, a break.
Yes. So it was an opportunity for us to walk up the hill and kind of sneak by the snipers. They cannot see us, but we were, I don't remember ever wearing shoes or flip-flops or anything. But it was just such a wonderful time where my brother and I, when the sun sets, we would go up with a 20-liter jerry can and bring some water back home. And we've been doing this back and forth for a while so that the water could be used for cooking, mostly. Shower if necessary, washing clothes and all that stuff. And also we started again to bring some food. But that was the greatest challenge because, you know, well, the currency there was no currency that we used in Somalia. So technically you don't have to go do a labor so you can be paid. So we were not expecting to get some cash back. But in this case, it was just like us going out just like the big cats do. Mm-hmm. And try to get something, meat or corn or wheat, you know, wheat or anything back home.
Foraging. Yeah.
Exactly. So we were just the foraging community, foraging kids in the middle, mm-hmm. in the city. So Mogadishu, where I was born, was leveled to the ground. And like I said, we used to play on these houses that was, you know, the houses were decorated with gunshots, bullets, and shellings and all that stuff. So the roofs were gone, everything was gone. So that's what the city looked like mostly. And some houses were even gone. You would not imagine there was a building here a few years ago. It was gone because that was like the battleground, you know, the kind of red line where the militias fought over things. So for us, we kind of lived wherever it felt good. And when I say good, I don't mean good. So it's like these militias are able to rule like a 3-mile area, right? And I thought that this because they're in control, nobody else can come. So we would live with them, meaning we would live under their rule. And the rule was the gun rules.
The gun always rules.
The gun always rules. That was it. So there was no police. There was no law. There was no norm, just nothing. It's like only thing that you need to understand is you have to respect these people with the guns. You don't even have to look at them, and eye contact could kill you, you know.
And this sets the stage for the middle part of your journey.
Yes.
And again, you know, as a child, you ended up practicing skills that you were going to need later. While I wouldn't want anyone to live in fear like that because it's so dangerous for your health and for your well-being, it's a good thing you did because you needed those skills as you went on. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You are listening to New Mainers Speak, and I'm Kate Manahan. My guest today is Abdi Iftin. He is an incredibly well-read man with a special connection to Maine. We've been focusing on his childhood, and so in the meantime, we didn't tell you about the fact that he was a refugee in Kenya for a number of years prior to winning the lottery, the diversity lottery for a visa to the United States, which he won and perilously found his way through the steeplechase of a process to get a visa to come to the United States. So can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up finding your way to Maine?
Before I talk about how I got here, the story is pretty long, you know. And to take you back, let's say 4 years ago, I was in Kenya as a refugee, and I left Somalia in 2011 when everything seemed like, you know, because like at that time I was in my 20s. And when you are at that age, that's when the militias like to recruit you. So you either have to join them or you get to be killed. And unfortunately, around that time, that's when Al-Shabaab, the Somali Islamist group, took over control of the country. And they have been training and recruiting young men of my age.
And very young, too, right? So they recruit. Yes. Children
well,
and then indoctrinate them.
They recruit children, but they also especially like the 20-year-olds.
Yeah, force you right into service.
You have the strength, you have the energy, you have all of that. And I think most of the militias were at that age, even though they had younger ones that they train. But those guys were the Hezbollah, you know, the police that wander around and ask people to go to the prairies and close shops and close businesses and stuff like that. Anyways, when Al-Shabaab came to the country, and that was when I could speak English. Which I learned from TV. And those were one of the fun things that happened in my childhood, where like someone started a movie theater business. And then we would go there. And she only had like six movies that she would play over and over and over all day long. You know, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger, Van Damme, Nicolas Cage, you know, all these big actors. But I especially liked Arnold Schwarzenegger movies because he is an immigrant. Well, I didn't know back then, but I thought that his accent was easy to understand. I thought that his English was quite clear.
Give us an Arnold Schwarzenegger line.
I'll be back. And
he taught you English. I love that.
So he did. And I was really kind of ready to grab everything. And the other people who were in the movie, they didn't like when Arnold Schwarzenegger talks to his daughter or to his family or to the other. They didn't like the talking part of it. They liked the action part of it. Like when he starts kicking, when he starts carrying this huge, automatic machine gun and starts spraying bullets all over, you know, his enemy. I thought, wow, this was amazing, and I liked it. But I also especially liked the communication that was going on. You know, before the war started, they were talking. They were just planning something, the plot. And I paid attention to that, and I listened over and over and over. And then I started, collecting words and phrases and sentences and put them together and move from there. And I started collecting whatever newspaper, magazine I could find thrown around on the streets, and I started reading them. You know,
so you needed that because you knew you were coming to the United States, so you better learn English.
I know, so that kind of prepared for my job in Maine, and this was probably 20 something years ago when I was at the movie theater, and I started translating for my friends.
Amazing.
Yeah, I became the translator though, even though I didn't speak that good English. I would say like, oh, he says he's going to throw the guy off the building. And it happens, you know. Oh, he says he's going to go get that guy, you know.
You must have seemed very powerful to them.
I kind of was. And then the American Marines came, and then Black Hawk Down happened, and the Americans left. And I was so sad. I was like, why did they leave? Why did they leave me behind? You know, those kind of stories. And then my friends started calling me American. So I got that name. Called me American.
That was your nickname.
That was my nickname.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
Did they call you American Abdi or just American?
Well, they called, some said Abdi American. They added Abdi. Some did not. They didn't even bother. They thought American was great. And whenever I heard American in the city, that was me. Trust me. where, you know, whenever I was walking on the street and somebody yells from there, up the America or America, I would just look back and wave, say, hey. And I kind of became like the guy on the street where, like, I would kind of imitate that I was, like, doing a hip-hop movement or the moonwalk of Michael Jackson or, you know, kind of pretend Arnold Schwarzenegger and talk to the people with a first wave, like, don't do that, kind of. I thought it was great. And then I had something. I thought that that was a passion for me. I thought that I liked it. I thought that was wonderful. You know, when you have a dream, when you have something to look forward to, the longing were like, I love this. You know, the Americans left, the movies are like that. And I thought, like, I really want to be in that place where these people leave.
Yeah, your life stunk. It was dangerous and scary. And you saw these other pictures on the TV, decided, I'm going to get some of that for myself.
Yeah.
And you just had this drive. And then added to that came the luck of just winning the diversity lottery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I would point out for listeners, if you want to hear this whole story, Abdi is not only an observant person who's kept a lot of information, he's also shared it. So he was doing audio recordings of his life, and he got picked up by a BBC reporter during this process, and he has also been a guest on This American Life. So if you just Google Abdi Eftin, or you can look at newmannerspeak.com, and I will link his website to all these other things you can listen to, you can get the full stories. I'm sorry we have to give you the abbreviated version today, because you have rich storytelling capabilities and you have a lot of stories.
Well, thank you. Thank you that you mentioned This American Life. Well, you know, when the first time someone called me and they said, This American Life wants to do a story about yourself. And I was like, who's This American Life? I didn't know them.
You weren't jumping up and down?
Yeah, I mean, no. And they were like, Ira Glass, you don't know him? This American Life? And honestly, I was like, what are you guys talking about? You know? And then, because I stay with this American family in Maine, and I asked them, well, This American Life wants to do on my story. And they were like, they all, like, you know, stood up from the seat and like,
they were jumping up and down.
Yeah, they were jumping up. Really? Really? You know, and then that's when I realized, wow, this looks really, you know, a big deal. And then that's when when I was in Kenya, I did the story. I was recording my story when the police were chasing me and that they were trying to deport Somalis back home. And I was one of the millions of people that were, you know,
intimidated.
Intimidated and preyed upon. The BBC called and they said, Jesus, you know, we want to do a story about your life. I said, okay, because I knew this was the British Broadcast Corporation is huge.
You knew that one.
I knew them. Yeah. I knew them from everywhere. And I thought it was great. I thought we could do it, you know. And then they gave me a recording device the size of a cell phone. And this was around when I won the lottery. But the Westgate hostage situation started
in the Kenyan mall.
Mm-hmm. And this was a Somali Islamist group, and they were killing and people on like the cameras recorded that.
This is what fear does to a society.
Yes.
Constant and fear.
And I think that was around 2013. That was around when Kenya was so, you know, fed up with the refugees, and they were thinking of closing down all the refugee camps, sending Somalis, you know, back to their country. And there was this negotiation going on with the United Nations, the King government, and all of this. And then the Westgate situation happened. So it was like they were already mad. And then now they're even worse, you know.
When I listened to your This American Life interview, I thought it was just a miracle you got out of there. And there are so many rich details in there. I hope people will tune into that piece. I'm afraid we're running short on time. And I wanted to make sure we said that you're a student at Southern Maine Community College, and you've been a speaker all over the state and will continue to do that at important venues. And you work as an interpreter at Catholic Charities of Maine presently. I know you have close connections to Mainers. I didn't know if you wanted to say a shout out to the family that has been so influential in your life and your transition here, but also what you plan to do with this life that you found yourself living here in America.
Well, first of all, America is kind of different when you see it on the media and the life of like living living in it. Especially Maine is such a remote place that does not represent.
We weren't on the movies.
Right, you were not in movies, and also it does not kind of represent the United States. Like, I live in Yarmouth, and I live on Sligo Road. It's like four-mile-long road, and there is no diversity. Like, I could be the only person of color walking up and down the street and doing my morning jog and everything else, and it's kind of weird. I'm like, where are the people? Where are the buildings? Where is the movie? Where's activity? Where's everything? You know, there's no bus, there's no train, there's literally like nothing. So you have to own a car to get to Portland, which is the only city in Maine that you could think of. Like, there's so many restaurants, there's a community connection, there's a grocery store where your people own. But I, you know, my childhood skills were like, I translated movies, you know, to my friends. And then I thought of, like, when I got here, one of the biggest struggles that the community go through is the language. And I thought, you know, because I have done at least 3 jobs before that, and most of them were labor, like insulation, Hanford, and all that stuff. And then I thought, I need to do something to try to reconnect myself to the community. And if, you know, if there's a way that I can contribute, you know, I would be happy to do that. And, you know, the translation job does not pay a lot. Like, you cannot be able to afford, like, big rent and all that stuff. But it's something that can get you, you know, connected to the community and meet people and help those that actually need the help of the, you know, the language, whether it's a hospital or a court or anything. So I actually took that job, and it got me deeply connected to the community, and got to know so many people. I got to know the real stories of what's happening in the community, and I became friends with so many people. But I also, you know, the most important thing in the U.S., like, you got to be something, you know. You have to fight for it. You have to strive for it. And I'm a fighter. My life
passed obviously
like that. Yeah. So that's why I actually started speaking at college and schools and all that stuff. And I traveled all the way up to Fort Kent, 8 hours drive.
So you were born to be here in the United States. You knew it when you were a kid. And now you're here. Do you have as much fortune telling abilities now for your future that you used to when you were a kid? Do you know what you're going to end up being doing?
I'm grown old. I'm 30 years old.
Now you're 30.
So I think but my dreams never die, you know. Now that I'm here in the US, I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm going to college, and I will graduate and do great stuff. So
what's your major?
Political science.
Political science. Yeah. Well, you're going to set the world on fire, Abdi. You are an unusual person and so bright and open to the opportunities that life offers you. You have an impressive story and a very promising future. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening. Please join us each week for similar interviews with diverse members of our community. If you'd like to hear this complete interview or interviews from previous weeks, please visit newmainerspeak.com and check out more related information at facebook.com/newmainerspeak. I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that Abdi has selected for us. Can you briefly tell why this song was the one that you chose, Abdi?
So this song is called Fraskaga Legabadi, and that's it kind of reminds me of my family. My father used to play this song over and over all the time, so it's like a memory.
And the name translated is "Your horse lost the race."
That's right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.